You're listening to the Sports Therapy Association podcast, putting evidence back into soft tissue therapy. And we're live. Hey, Ethel, how are you doing? Welcome to the Sports Therapy Association podcast, episode 196, entitled Treating the Shoulder, Steps to Success, with my special guest, Joe Gibson, a hugely respected shoulder specialist, educator, and upper limb rehab specialist at Rehab for Performance. My name is Matt Phillips, creator of runchatlive.com. And as always, this episode of the Sports Therapy Association podcast is being recorded live on a Tuesday at 8 o'clock on the Sports Therapy Association YouTube channel and Facebook page. So if you are listening to the podcast and you fancy joining us for the live recording one week, then all you need to do is head over to either of those at 8 o'clock on a Tuesday. And you'll be able to ask the questions to the guests directly. You can hang out with like-minded individuals in the live lounge and generally just have a great time. If you do decide to join us live, then I can bring your questions up onto the screen, like Nikki Mansfield has just come into the house. Hey, 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 says Nikki. How are you doing, Nikki? Thanks for joining us. So it is also a chance for you to share your logo, share your name and network a little bit. Anne Cochrane next to the door as well. Hey, Anne, how are you doing? Thanks for joining us. Anne says, hello, hello. Hope you're all good. What a lovely bunch of people so far. So friendly. That's how we rolled here at the Sports Therapy Association podcast. So yeah, there is your opportunity. But if you do decide it's easy for you to watch the listen to the podcast, and that's fine. That's great. Just do us the favor, if you could, of leaving a rating and review, because it helps the good word of our guests get out there even more. Right then, before I bring up my guest for tonight, Joe Gibson, then I must give a huge thanks to last week's guest, a very special guest, Professor Ian Horsley. If you did miss it, then obviously the episode is on all popular podcast apps and YouTube, if you like the video. It was called Shoulder Assessment Qualitative versus Quantitative, giving fantastic insight into the limitations of quantitative heavy traditional approach. Which is really interesting, because we've talked a lot of on the shows about the importance of having a dynamometer. Try saying that three times, but yeah, a dynamometer, and how it can be useful to show tangible kind of progression in rehabilitation and that. But it was a really interesting twist in the last episode, in episode 195, of how the limits of using that, and how the importance of movement-based training over focusing solely on muscle groups, including vestibular rehabilitation, which I heard people in the audience screaming out and applauding, because that's very interesting at the moment. A lot of people talking about that. And there's also details of upcoming webinars and courses with Professor Ian Horsley as well. Links are all provided in the podcast notes. So yeah, that's all there for you to enjoy and educate yourselves. As always, like I say, if you are listening to the podcast and you want to join us live and ask questions directly, then like I say, just come along to the YouTube at 8 o'clock on a Tuesday. Right, the rooms are filling up. So I think without further ado, we can commence episode 196, Treating the Shoulder, Steps to Success, with special guest Joe Gibson.
You're listening to the Sports Therapy Association podcast, putting evidence back into soft tissue therapy.
Hey, Joe, how are you doing?
Hey, Matt, good to be here. Thanks for the invite.
It's great. It's really nice. We were talking a little bit off air. I think the last time we met and spoke, ashamedly for me, being the podcast host, was probably 11 years ago, Therapy Expo 2013.
Yep.
Sorry.
It's all right.
I didn't mean to call. I said I'd call you, didn't I? Sorry.
Yeah, well, you couldn't escape. I've tracked you down finally.
It's nothing personal. But yeah, great to finally. It's ridiculous, isn't it? 11 years. Unbelievable. But anyway, here we are. They do say that research takes about 13 years or something to get from research to clinic floor, doesn't it? So that's fine. We'll just blame it on that. Nikki says here, oh, look, we've already got some fan people in already. Nikki says, I did Joe's course years ago. Okay, don't make her feel too old.
Thanks, Nikki.
Looking forward to hearing how understanding of shoulder issues has changed or not over the years. That'd be very interesting as well. Cecily Hislop says, evening all, looking forward to this episode. And Gary Benson, founder of the STA, is here as well, saying, evening all, looking forward to this one. No pressure, Joe.
Thanks.
So yeah, it's true. I mean, it was when I was thinking how to introduce you, because you've done so much, and it's great, because in the circles I mix in, you are very well known, and we've got loads of colleagues in common. But I always hope that it's a bit of a bubble, and there's lots and lots. I know there's lots and lots of people out there who fortunately haven't heard of you, and that's exciting for me, because it means they've got, they can learn and benefit from. So, but to introduce you, I just love your Twitter handle, which you created in 2013, Shoulder Geek One. And the fact you've got the one there is like, accept no imitation. I am the geek. No one else, you know. I think I found about Shoulder Geek 36 on there as well. So people have followed, but it's not the same. And that was 11 years ago, and now you've got 30,500 followers. Not that the number of followers is important. And we laughed at how you hit that Twitter button post 45,500 times.
Traveling and sitting in conferences, usually when I'm a bit disengaged, I think.
That's a brilliant statistic. Amazing. Anyway, for people who are not aware of you, and I'm hoping that people listening to the podcast are not aware, which is fine. This is great. It's what this is all about. Could you give us a little bit, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up being Shoulder Geek One and where you are today?
That just shows my ignorance of social media, and I didn't realize what I was doing at the time. And now I just can't change it because it's just too hard. Yeah. So my current job, as you very kindly introduced, I'm a preliminary rehab specialist at Rehab for Performance in Liverpool in the UK. And I'm also an honorary senior research fellow at Liverpool Hope University, which is where Ian and I obviously overlap. And then until 2 years ago, I was a clinical specialist working in the NHS, and that was a job I did for 28 years. I was in the NHS for 35 years altogether. Hated treating shoulders at the very beginning. Did a rotation with a guy called Angus Wallace, who is probably more famous now for doing chest drains on airplanes up in the air, but was a very famous shoulder surgeon. Massively passionate about arthroplasty, which I have to say is not the most exciting thing in the world. And it just always resonated. And then I hated treating shoulders. They never got better. A bit of ultrasound and postural correction didn't get anybody better, which now is probably not a great surprise. But then went on what was then called a muscle imbalance course, and remember sitting there thinking, oh yeah, maybe I need to do some exercise. So that was a kind of eureka moment, and then needed a challenge. And the guy who trained with Prof Wallace came to Nottingham to be a professor. So I was very lucky to get the job as his shoulder specialist. And yeah, the rest is history, really. And just had an amazing opportunity to set up a specialist unit, which has just grown from strength to strength. And I've left in the hands of an amazing team.
Fantastic. So yeah, there's an awful lot. How long did you say? 28 years at the...
28 years in one job. Yeah. In one unit. Yes. It took a long time.
That is incredible. You must get this all the time, but and Nikki has kind of summarized it as well, but oh my God, Jo looks exactly the same as she did back then. If there's time
the
after
camera,
all
the lighting and the face.
She says, if there's time after all this shoulder shizzle, please don't let her leave without sharing the secret of eternal youth.
Oh, Nikki, you're very kind. You can come on the course again. Fabulous. Thank you.
But that is, yeah, it must be crazy when you look back and think of all the things you've done and the time you spent there. I'm interested, what made you kind of come out from the NHS? And was it a couple of years ago? When did you?
2 years ago, yeah. 2 years ago, January. Yeah, 2 years in January, just gone. Oh, such a great question. Lots of reasons. I'd had a private practice with a partner. She wants to retire. We sold that to somebody who worked for us, and I carried on working there. Matt and Chris, who are the directors at Rehab for Performance, contacted me and said, look, we're setting up this new clinic. We'd love you to come and do our shoulder consultancy. And I said, oh, well, I'm actually looking for a bit more of a challenge because I'm seeing all these sports people and I kind of need better facilities. And to be honest, I did a retire and return in the NHS, went down to 2 days, which is always a mistake because you end up doing a 4 day job in two and taking everything else home. And if I'm honest, Matt, I think I was just burnt out. My life had morphed into doing my teaching, my online courses, doing consultancy with sports stuff, as well as seeing other, patients that had failed elsewhere privately. And I think I felt a huge responsibility with the unit because I'd always driven it. I'd always had the ideas, and the team coming up behind who then were alongside me were just phenomenal, and younger and energy and less spread responsibilities. And I think sometimes you just need to recognize that it's time for other people to take the reins. And Simon, who set the unit up with me, died at the beginning of COVID. So there was a kind of changing of the guard. And, all the people there, I miss them hugely, but it was so the right decision because they're absolutely flying. And I would love to think I never stopped them flying, but when the old bird's still there, it's easy to ask, and what do you think? And it's a bit like, well, it's not what I think anymore. It's kind of over to you. And they're flying, and they've made everything we wanted to happen happen. So I'm immensely proud of them all. Miss them horribly, but I do not miss my job, which all got very stressful, trying to do everything in 2 days and not really being able to do it terribly well. So yeah.
So I guess now you're kind of spoilt at having I mean, I don't know, I'm presuming here, but you've got more time with patients, I imagine. There's a lot of kind of generalizations, but we assume that one of the things of moving into private is you get more time, which has got its advantages as well. Might take a bit more, well, not for you because you're like superstar, but no, it takes a little bit more advertising and you haven't got patients being given to you and handed to come through the door every 15 minutes. But is it something that you think, I mean, because the reason I ask is a lot of sports therapists, a lot of audience are not physios, are sports therapists or sports massage therapists, and they kind of have this imposter syndrome we've talked about a lot, like, yeah, I'm pretty good at my job, but I'm not a physio. And it's like, oh, I'm not sure about this. I should send them to a physio. And sometimes, depending on your level of experience, it is important to refer out. And that's part of the most, one of the most important things about being a sports therapist and any profession, I think, is knowing what you don't know and being able to refer out. But I think a lot of people don't realize that being a physio, especially NHS, is like a totally different job. It's not all MSK. It's not going to be maybe doing what you want to do. So what advice would you have for sports therapists who think, oh, yeah, I'm a good sports therapist, but I'm not a physio?
Oh, I think you need to be really proud of the skills that you've got. And I think, you know, physio is in a very interesting place at the moment because it's railing against many of the skills that we thought were inherent, like manual therapy and any of our hands-on stuff. And it's quite a battle, I think, certainly for some of the physios who've been around a bit, trying to deal with some of the social media noise at the moment. But I think as sports therapists, I think you kind of, you're in an amazing place because you kind of really recognize where healthcare is going. And, you know, the problem we've got in the NHS is that you have, even in musculoskeletal world, you've got a waiting list, which is 60 to 70% made up of people with comorbidities who are overweight, who smoke, who don't exercise, etc. So to see sports in the NHS is like a tiny, tiny part of what we see. And the other thing is, if you do see them, the opportunity to take people to a level that truly gets them back to what they want to do is not without its challenges, particularly if you work in acute care, because the priority is to settle things down and then send people off. So, no, I think sports therapists should embrace the role that they've got, because I think, you know, they're masters of many different areas. And I think it's something that really reflects where healthcare needs to be at the moment.
That's really cool. I'm sure that's really helped, you know, a lot of our listeners and people out there, because it's always kind of there. But we're also fortunate. I think, you know, sometimes people kind of ask me, why do you have so many physios on the show? But I'm like saying, you shouldn't be looking at what they are. Look at what comes out of their mouth. Look what they're saying. Because whilst you're thinking, oh, it's a physio, you're forgetting the fact they're talking about, oh, yeah, multidisciplinary care. Like some people, I can guarantee, will just still be thinking, oh, Joe Gibson physio. And they're not listening to what you're saying, even though you're bigging up their career. So it's getting a bit better. I like to think it's getting a bit better. And places like Therapy Expo now, where like this year, we're really striving to make sure the MSK Commons is not a separate kind of strange place over there. What do they do in there? It's kind of like all part of looking after patient now. You know, it's
exactly.
All, you know, that's what we're trying to do this year. So, which is very different.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, going on from that, I work with sports therapists. The courses that I teach are not solely for physios. We get sports therapists coming. My son plays football and the sports therapists are the kind of the physios in the team. And I've all given them all free places to my course because I think we're all in this together. And all I'm interested in is making sure the things that I found of help for patients are available to as many people working with patients so they feel confident, empowered, you know, whatever comes through the door. So I think, you know, the boundaries, I guess, are professional and dictated by our professional bodies, but there's a lot of overlap. And again, it's just respecting your skill level and expertise. And I mean, there's loads of physios that hate treating the shoulder, you know, it's like, it's not a unique thing. And at the end of the day, we're just all trying to do the best for the patient in front of us. And that's what drives me.
Definitely. That's a very good, yeah. Just think about the patient and a lot of these problems and questions just disappear. Great. I'm just going to put up on the screen for those of you, if you're listening to the podcast, you can't see what I'm sharing on the screen. So my apologies, but I'm just going to put up there for people who have joined us live, the website to have a little look at, rehabforperformance.com. Very nice website. I don't know who looks after, but it's beautiful. Graphics are something to behold. And also it's lovely to see the different stuff that you offer. I mean, you've even got a picture of somebody receiving soft tissue therapy on there, which is like very progressive indeed.
We have soft tissue therapists working with us. It's a great, exactly. It is a real delight.
Check it out, people. Look, true multidisciplinary care. You've got so much going on there. It's lovely. Really nice website. And it's like a great unit. Beautiful place. Envious for a lot of people, I'm sure. And that's in Liverpool, isn't it? So if people do want to check you out, then that's where you need to go. Great. Right. Let's get into the question at hand then, the shoulder steps to success. Now, this is obviously, we're not here, we mentioned this off air, I'm not here just to sell Joe's course. I mean, not everybody will need Joe's course. Not everyone, you might be like me and look after runners and run away from a shoulder and you just don't see them anymore. So you can forget about them, put them in a little box and nail it shut. But if you are looking for some information on shoulders, and that's what a lot of your clients are, then I'm just recommending that this is one of the options you should have a look at. And for this show, I think it makes sense to have a look at what the course entails, because that's stuff you've chosen, which you think this is what therapists out there need. That's why it's on the course. So I'm interested with, I mean, the title itself, Shoulder Steps to Success. We kind of touched on last week with Professor Ian Horsley that the shoulder is regarded as quite a scary, complex joint. It's not like a knee, which just flexes and extends. It's got all this weird range of motion and positions it can put itself in. And then apparently it's got these four rotator cuff muscles kind of things, which if one of those goes, then you're stuffed. But do you find that this is one of the things which makes kind of treatment and rehab of the shoulder difficult? There's kind of a fear of it.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, it's not just one joint. You've got four or five joints if you include physiological joints. It kind of, you know, again, it gets bad press. It's complicated. You know, so much of its stability is dependent on the muscles. All the research that comes out says we can't diagnose anything. So none of those messages are particularly helpful for people. And I think that's why it gets bad press. And I have to say, I usually start my course saying how many people actually like treating the shoulder. And I have to say they're generally in the minority. And when I ask them why, it's like, well, it's complicated. I can't work out what's happening. I can't diagnose anything. And I think the good news is certainly in non-traumatic shoulder pain, a lot of the time it doesn't matter whether you can diagnose it or not, because there's some key things that will work with the majority of patients done well for long enough. And so, yeah, there's some kind of simple things that are very well supported, but the evidence kind of questions our ability to really do anything very useful in that kind of diagnostic domain. And I think that really underpins a loss of clinician confidence.
It's interesting, because I know you touched on this in your course with the kind of importance of language and stuff. I think when I do hear from patients or people even in the street or who have got shoulder issues, one of the first things, and they've obviously been told it because they didn't come to this conclusion themselves, but they've been seeing one person, and you can guarantee that therapist will go, oh well, the shoulder joint, I mean, it's in this tiny socket, it's like a golf ball on the tee, it's like a saucer, it's amazing it even stays in there without falling out. And I think sometimes, because that's how you learn it with anatomy, yeah, you learn straight away, oh, the most unstable joint in the body. Now if you say that to a patient, now again, I mean, 10 years ago, I'm sure we all kind of said that without even thinking about it. And then thanks to people like Mike Stewart and that, and OPA Mike and that, we're kind of thinking, actually, yeah, maybe I shouldn't say that. Maybe I should take that off my shelf with the kind of meniscus hanging off the knee. But it is really important, I think, with the shoulder, the language we do use with patients, because there is a tendency to describe it as the most unstable joint and then hope they get better.
Oh, absolutely. And to be honest, I mean, a lot of my job is seeing patients who've perhaps failed with other people. And I would love to say I have some magic tricks and I do all sorts of voodoo to get them better. But, you know, I can't tell you how often it's because of poor messaging or what the person's heard. So, of course, we've been through this whole thing with impingement. And now if you're a shoulder specialist, you kind of frown on the word impingement. Oh, we don't call it that anymore. We call it cuff-related shoulder pain. And then somebody else will say, oh, no, we call it cuff tendinopathy. And then it's like nobody actually knows what they call it. So we've just put it under this big umbrella. And for a patient, that's the killer, because if your GP says you've got impingement and then you go see a physio who tells you you've got rotator cuff-related shoulder pain, and then you go to a chiropractor who says it's something else, everybody thinks they're being clever in helping the patient, and all they're actually doing is confusing them and not at any point checking what that means to the patient. So I definitely have patients who come to see me and I say, well, what have you been told by the people you've seen? And they'll say, oh, well, I think I've got impingement. I say, well, what does that mean to you? And if they say, oh, I think I, you know, need some exercise or some treatment to help it get better, then I'm not going to change that narrative, but I will prepare them for what's out there on Google. So yeah, you know, impingement's one term. There's a whole lot of other terms. And if you go and look in Google, you'll see cuff tears, impingement, bursitis, whatever. The good news is it doesn't matter. It all comes under this umbrella and we treat it the same. So we kind of prepare them, the Google searcher, the person who comes in with it written down. However, if I have a patient and I ask them what it means and they say, well, it means I've got a bit of bone sticking in my cuff and it needs chopping off, then of course that's going to be a different conversation once I've done my assessment. But again, I think, I mean, I always smile, and this is one of the, I guess, the privileges of teaching is that I have to keep on top of the evidence. But, you know, it wasn't that long ago that people were saying to us, don't say anything about structure. So don't mention cuff tears. Just say it's normal age-related change, which, of course, it is in a lot of patients. However, we now know from some recent studies that saying normal age-related pain, normal age-related changes to some patients makes them think, I'm never going to get better because it's my age. So we kind of try and look for this magic bullet of explanation and diagnosis and description. And the fact is, it's different for each individual. So where Mike, no pain Mike, is so amazing, is it's not even about us finding the metaphors sometimes. It's just helping patients understand in a way that resonates with them. So the label directs a pathway of care and allows them to feel confident we know what we're going to do for that thing. But in non-traumatic, non-stiff, non-unstable shoulder pain, actually most things respond to the same interventions. And I love what you said about the unstable shoulder, because it's just like, you know, I still can't believe we did this. We had a clinic and we called it the Complex Instability Clinic, and that went on a letter to the patients. And it was like, guys, what were we doing? You know, hindsight's a great thing. So yeah, I think you just have to, to me, and again, the steps to success, the number one is talk less, listen more, you know, because the patients give you the clues, but you also get to the nub of what they're scared about, worried about, the barriers that are going to stop you being able to get them back to what they want to do.
That's brilliant. There's so much in there for people to unpack there. I really like it. And maybe it is because therapists are a little bit more worried about the shoulder that they feel they need to kind of label and categorize it. And they're not as happy with the knee saying, oh, yes. They're just worried about it. So they love these terms. And even the term frozen shoulder is just like such I can imagine as a patient, you know, it's just a dodgy word. It's going to make you think it's frozen. You know, it's like my shoulder's frozen. But, and then obviously people start thinking, oh, surgery, I'm going to need surgery. And they're less likely to follow conservative measures because they think they've got something so serious that it's just not going to be able to, they're not going to be able to do anything to it. So.
It's actually really interesting, Matt. Sorry, just because some recent research that came up that's really interesting about people thinking there's something seriously wrong with their shoulder. Because there was a study that looked at clinicians and patients, and they videoed the consultations, and they said to the clinicians, do you think people with shoulder pain worry that they have something seriously wrong with their shoulder? And went, oh, no, not as much as people with back pain. And actually, when they asked the patients, it was the other way around. So more patients with shoulder pain worry there is something seriously wrong and need somebody to say to them explicitly, I am not worried there's something seriously wrong with your shoulder, which is, again, it's just all these little bits that we can learn that are the really potential barriers. Yeah, 100%.
That's really interesting because I always kind of thought maybe lower back pain is on people's minds because you can't quite see it. You can't, your hand's there and you're trying to feel it out. But shoulder you can see, and yet people are still nervous about it. And yeah, very interesting. Actually, I should give a shout out to Israel, who I know has hurt his shoulder and he's joining here tonight because he's looking for some inspiration. And also, he's my barber, so hence the expression, lovely haircut.
Oh, your thanks, haircut. Israel. I was going to say, it's been rude about mine.
Oh, no, sorry, I should have said that. There you go. There's someone in there admiring your hair there, Joe. So that's nice. Thanks, Israel. It's really nice of you to say that.
I never get those comments, that's for sure, with this mop.
Very kind. Let's go to questions here because we've got so much we could cover and we really could fill it so easily this hour. But I'm interested, if any of you have got questions, then do bring them up because now is the moment where you could really get someone to explain it clearly and accurately. So Israel actually has followed that up with a question saying, what about multiple shoulder dislocated? How should that be treated? Thanks. There you go.
Thanks. So bottom line is it's very dependent on the history, whether they've got a clear original mechanism of trauma or not. We tend to, in the UK, use a classification system called the Stanmore Triangle, which really looks at subgroups. So primarily your young traumatic dislocator who falls over, dislocates their shoulder, has to have it relocated by somebody else. And if they're under 25, want to get back to sport, there is some argument that if you scan their shoulder and find something that's relevant structurally, then surgery is probably the best way of getting them back to what they want to do. However, of course, there's a whole grey area within that. And objectively, Ian talked about the apprehension test last week. So you'd want them to continue to be apprehensive. However, there's lots of people with structural injuries that rehab really well. However, there's still a lot of surgeons that won't operate the first time. So it's always about teasing out, was their original mechanism of trauma, particularly when they were younger, so under the age of 25, who is now presenting with a recurrent dislocation in a very specific position. And so in that, if they've not had imaging, for me, then imaging is going to be up there, particularly if clinically they're apprehension positive, etc. However, you will also get a group with hypermobility. So this is what's called the type 2 on the Stanmore, but I really wouldn't worry about it. It's traumatic or not. difficult when it's minor trauma on a background of hypermobility, because you don't need as much trauma to cause structural damage. But fundamentally, at times of growth spurts, at times of stress, at times of change of activity, some of these young stretchy people can start to sublux their shoulder posteriorly and then get recurrent episodes over time. And in both situations, it's just about that dynamic stability system not doing its job as effectively as it can, highly correlated with the neuromuscular control elements that Ian talked about last week. But generally, about 80% of that non-traumatic group do well with rehab. But again, that's why it's so important to know what the original precipitating mechanism was. And there's a third group, which you're unlikely to see, and that we saw quite a lot in our tertiary referral center, are those groups that don't necessarily have to have hypermobility or laxity, but the muscles around the shoulder, like the lats and the pecs, work so hard as a protective strategy. So again, highly correlated with growth spurts, times of stress, etc., mental health issues, learning, there's a whole gambit, that the muscles actually pull the shoulder out every time they lift it up. So I think the important thing to say is the majority of instability you see, irrespective if you're going to do conservative management, the ingredients are very similar. So as well as the kind of basic foundations I'd apply to any shoulder problem, the big difference with instability is you have bigger neuromuscular deficits. So both in terms of that get ready for action, that feed forward up regulation, but also that reactive stabilization. So weight bearing, closed chain exercises are brilliant for anything for that feed forward. And then reactive stuff, your drop and catch, your plyometrics, your cable catches, all that kind of stuff, as early as you can possibly do, are great in terms of that reactive element. And then another thing I know Ian mentioned last time about the kinetic chain, also making sure they're not protecting and they're engaging through their kinetic chain in a way that's functionally relevant. So yeah, again, instability just signposts probably more, even more focus on those neuromuscular elements.
That's very interesting, because we're hearing a lot more about the neuromuscular element, and it was kind of topic at Therapy Expo last November. There was quite a few great speakers who were talking about that, and I loved the term. I can't remember who now who came up originally. It might have been Angela Jackson, it could be Andrew McCauley, but it was just this chaos. I hadn't heard the word that, and recreating the chaos of a real life sporting, and most sports are pretty chaotic. Maybe not darts, I don't know, but is darts a sport? I don't know, that's not really
but it depends how many beers we've had, I suspect.
I'm wondering whether that's an issue with rehab, because it was interesting. I think it was Andy Jackson actually who said that one of the things that sparked her interest was it keeps resurfacing that one of the biggest predictors of injury is past injury. And it's like, 100%. Why is that the case? Maybe it's because we're missing something in the rehab, because we're all giving these rehab out and this kind of like gold standard, and yet all these people are still getting injured again. And that's where, hopefully, you never know, obviously it's not gonna be everything, but maybe that's an element which traditionally people haven't concentrated on. So is that something you touch on in the course? Is that one of the steps to success? Well, you've already kind of insinuated it is, but How can we do that?
So, well, I think there's a couple of things in what you've just said there. I mean, Matt Taberner is the guy who described the whole control to chaos continuum.
Great.
And he's actually applied it to a basketball example. So definitely worth looking up for anybody who's interested in rehab, because it kind of takes you through that whole kind of phase, if you like. And I think when I look at my course, but I also look at the question you've just asked, the bottom line is, if I say I get asked to review a rugby player, top of his game, he's going to have passed all his strength and power measures. He's going to be all over it in terms of the quantitative stuff. And so it's like, well, how do I measure that neuromuscular system? And so I think where people like Claire Minchell, you know, that have obviously done a lot of stuff about rate of force production, Ben Ashworth, who's described his ASH test, I now have things that I can measure that show me how well that patient can engage their neuromuscular system and how much they can maintain it working well and produce load at the same time. So I can kind of use that as an objective test, but then the great thing with the shoulder, it's such an attention monster. You give it a bit of peripheral input and you'll change something. So I can immediately then look at the impact of closed chain exercise, reactive exercise, maybe just a three range recruitment exercise, and then see, has it improved that objective? So again, it tells me, yes, I've made a difference to how that neuromuscular system is functioning. So I think in terms of the course, it's like, well, just understand what it is that allows that system to do its job and how negatively it's affected by not only injury, but patient beliefs. And then fundamentally, also, let's understand all the really simple things that can change what it's like for somebody to move with shoulder pain. And once you've got those foundations, then it's the exciting bit is just making it look like what they want to get back to. And it was really interesting hearing Ian last week actually talking about, you know, the, and I get what he's saying about the qualitative, but I think in terms of empowering clinicians, it's having some baselines that mirror what we're doing with our rehab. So there's that combination of those two things that give transparency, but also the things that, because I've just done it for a long time, I look at, I see it and I think, yeah, I need to address that. So I've tried to break down, if you like, the approach to the influence of all those sensory things into a very simple approach to symptom modification. But then when you get to that chaos level, really once you're into chaos, I want to know that athlete's ready to go. But you can introduce lower levels of along that control to chaos continuum that really target that neuromuscular system.
Hey there, Matt Phillips here. Sorry to interrupt the podcast. Just 60 seconds to remind you that if you're looking for beard grooming products, there is a Sports Therapy Association discount code that will get you 15% off at The Brighton Beard Company, website thebrightonbeardcompany.co.uk. Yes, I am biased, what with Brighton being my hometown, but The Brighton Beard Company really do offer an absolutely amazing selection of luxurious beard balms and impeccably scented oils, all handmade in small batches with 100% natural ingredients. Their current spring collection, for example, contains bergamot, coriander, thyme and lavender, giving you a fresh and energizing essence with both citrusy and peppery notes, making it the perfect gift for you, a family member or any friend with facial hair. Go to thebrightonbeardcompany.co.uk and get 15% off now by entering the discount code STA15. Doesn't include already discounted bundles.
So you mentioned rugby. I mean, for people who are still struggling with the idea of chaos, we're just kind of just talking about when you go on the pitch. It's all very well doing your rehab where you're in a nice safe place with mats and you're doing a nice kind of shoulder rotation with a band or something. Even if you've got lots of weight, but it's what you're not doing is reacting to a 20-stone rugby player suddenly intercepting you laterally and pushing you over or tackling you. One of the cases of Israel, for example, he's got to get back into jiu-jitsu. That's where he injured it and that's what he wants to get back to doing. So rehab for somebody like that, can you give us a few ideas of what sort of rehab people should be doing to prepare for that with regards to the shoulder, which maybe they're not doing?
So definitely the foundations first, because I think, again, in physio, we've suddenly had this huge shift that we're all about strength all of a sudden, even though we don't really have any evidence of superiority, apart from actually in sport, where there's definitely some performance markers of typical strength measurements. And we actually have quite a lot of data, normative data in rugby. So for me, it's all about the basics in terms of cuff strength, rotational in relevant positions. Once they've got it mid-range, then have they got it inner and outer range? Then looking at power measures, absolutely looking at rate of force production, because to me, that's a really brilliant measure of their kind of neuromuscular abilities as well. We put them through a whole gambit of tests. But in terms of then, if I had somebody say after stabilization surgery, we would start things like perturbation training. So their opposite arm in the dislocation position, maybe with a band attached, walking around them, pulling it in lots of different directions. We might get them doing plyometrics. We might get them doing drop and catch all on the unaffected arm, because you get this cross education effect that still lights up the same cortical pathways. So we want somebody to be working in the position they dislocated in the opposite arm as soon as we can. And then as the surgery or the injury allows, then we're going to do exactly the same on the affected arm. So almost.
Right, sorry, I want to pause you there, because that was, you said like cortical, blah, 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 blah. So,
okay. And, sorry,
and it's a really interesting point, because I'm interested if that is like, if that's been seen, if that's shown up in functional MRI. So you're working the asymptomatic side. So and if you, there's a crossover.
Yeah. So if you look, there's a whole kind of research base about cross education. So I could put this arm in a sling and I could work this arm at 70% of my one repetition max for 6 weeks, and the arm in the sling would get stronger.
That's
so
beautiful.
Some of it's cortical effects, some of it's overflow because you're working this side hard. So you're obviously going to get those postural perturbations and stuff. But again, somebody's had a fracture who's in a sling, somebody's had surgeries in a sling. It means there's stuff you can do to minimize the negative effects of that. And when I think, when we look at that link of injury and a risk of re-injury, there's several things. One of them is neuromuscular control. Two is underestimating the impact that has on an athlete's confidence that until recently we've not been so good at measuring. And thirdly, that influences their decision making when they go back. So if you go back to the rugby analogy, I had to do a talk recently actually at the IOC conference, and it was kind of looking at that. How can you make that athlete as robust as possible when they go back into a max situation where you can't predict what's going to happen? And one of the big things is that you can actually see in some athletes who've dislocated their shoulder, when you watch them go back to play, they go completely the wrong side of a tackle. So they're more likely to re-dislocate because there's that subconscious protection. So I think where the evidence is cool is it's signposting all these things. But it's then, oh my goodness, what does that mean to my rehab to then make sure they can cope with that chaos? So there's so many different factors, but that's what's fun.
Yes, exactly. Which is a really cool word to use. We've had a few great educators using the word fun, because if your rehab isn't fun, then potentially that's like a red flag that you're not actually preparing yourself for the fun you're going to have on pitch or something. So there needs to be that element of surprise, spontaneity, invention, reaction and stuff. I think that's probably quite a good sign, because unfortunately is probably the right word. This is probably my next question to you. How, if you are a patient, how do you kind of make sure that you're going to go to a therapist who's up to date and is going to incorporate all of this? All right, that's a pretty tricky question, but you just go there. What, you know, it's hard, isn't it? Because unfortunately, there's a lot of therapists who don't listen to this show. They don't know you, and they just don't know these things, because like research doesn't travel down. They don't go to therapy expo and all that. So for patients, it's really tricky. It's a bit of a minefield, because you could end up with somebody who, I don't want to dismiss the role of stuff like acupuncture or whatever, because that can all regulate pain and bring sensitivity down and help that person then open to something else. But if they're not doing this reactive stuff and not thinking about this vestibular training and stuff, how do patients choose these days?
I think it's really tough. And I think certainly if you're going back to sport, you need to be with somebody who doesn't have to actually be a specialist in your sport, that needs to understand sport. So there's no way I could be an expert in all the different sports for the patients that come to see me. It's impossible. But as soon as I see somebody who does a sport, I had a guy that played underwater hockey for Britain the other day. What is all that about? Of course, I had to watch some videos about that. But that's what's fun. You watch them and you work out where the shoulder's under load and what that shoulder's going to be able to do. And then you almost reverse engineer it back to where you need to start with your rehab. And then it's okay, how do I make sure I've filled in the neuromuscular demands of that particular task? And then the chaos is just putting it under more challenge as you progress. So I think for patients, somebody who listens for sure, and somebody who's not afraid to, I mean, I've had patients where I've said, look, I don't really understand that. Can I speak to your coach, or have you got a video, or have you got this? And patients really respect that. So as long as you're all over the basics of good quality rehab and understanding how a shoulder functions and what it needs to function well, then you can work out the rehab. But if you don't have those basic things, then you'll potentially disturb your patient. So it is hard work. So a patient needs to trust you and know you're going to put the work in to understand what's relevant to them, I think.
I think that's a really nice answer. I was worried then, I was putting you on the spot a bit. Then I thought, hold on, Matt, you're talking to Joe Gibson. There is no spot.
No, there is no spot. A diplomat.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great advice. If you're a patient and, yeah, you go to a therapist who is not listening, they've got the answer as soon as you walk in the door. They start putting on this program because it works for everyone else. And it looks like they're over certain. Then that's probably a clue that they just know too much, because it is uncertain. Every time an individual walks in, it's a new person, an individual with a different history, different physiology, different expectations, different fears. So being at peace with uncertainty and working with you, I guess, is a really good indication that they're a bit more progressive and contemporary and up to date, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely.
I like it. There you go. That's good. You've blown a few minds here, mic drop moments here. Nikki Mansfield says, wow, that contralateral shizzle stuff is amazing.
It is. It's pretty cool. I agree, Nikki. It's very cool.
Isabel's gone. He's gone, what? That's amazing, with 4 or 5 question marks. So yeah,
it's very, very cool. I think there was a question about a Hill Sachs lesion. I think
yes.
I spotted that when I put my glasses on.
So thank you very much.
Read anything without.
This is Sharon from Osteopathic Clinic Watton, and Sharon says, "Hi, Sharon here. Can you explain the best treatment for an acute Hill Sachs bony injury with associated lateral tear? Would it always be surgery?"
Oh, so great question. No, it doesn't always mean surgery. So, and this is, again, is where I say, you know, having, you always want an MR arthrogram to get the most information, because plain MR is a little bit fallible with label tears. But when it comes to Hill sacs, which is that basically humeral head, when it goes over the rim of the glenoid, you get an impaction fracture. So it looks a bit like Pac-Man. They're all probably all too young to know who Pac-Man is.
I've got it.
If you've got it, Matt, that's all good. Yeah. So Pac-Man. Now, the thing is, it doesn't really matter how big that impaction fracture is. What matters is, I'm trying to do this in the thing. What matters is, as the arm goes up into the wrist position, does that impaction fracture engage on the rim, or does it stay inside the rim? If it stays inside the rim, it's called an on-track or non-engaging Hill sacs. That has no increased risk of dislocation. However, if it engages on the rim, and generally patients will be really apprehensive when you try and take them into that position, it's an off-track or engaging Hill sacs, and then you have a 100% chance of redislocating. So then it's a no-brainer that surgery is going to be a good option for you. So it's putting together that clinical picture of how apprehensive they are. You know they've got a structural problem, and therefore that helps you build things up. In terms of the label tears themselves, honestly, it's not useful to go into all the different types of label tear that might make you have a higher risk of redislocation, because that's kind of the surgeon and the radiologist's job. But for you, objectively, with that finding, ongoing apprehension, not getting better with rehab, surgery is definitely an option. But just having the Hill sacs alone is not a reason.
Great question, Shan. Thank you very much. Yeah, feel free to ask questions, people, because it's so nice getting questions from clinicians. It's like, That's what the podcast needs, is more questions from clinicians. There's another great question here from Cecily. A great question that this is being asked on podcast. So, hi, this is perhaps a bit generic, but what do you think can help menopausal women if they're experiencing shoulder pain? We as therapists can't affect hormone levels, but what can we do? Cheers.
Oh, what a topical question.
Great.
So we suspected the link between hormones and a risk of frozen shoulder for years and years and years. But there's actually a paper came out, Wittstein et al, 3,000 ladies. And they actually found that ladies who had symptoms of menopause who weren't on HRT were twice as likely to get frozen shoulder. Interestingly, people on HRT with well-controlled symptoms were half as likely to get frozen shoulders. So there is definitely finally some evidence to support that hormonal link. Again, it seems to be a symptomatic menopause or perimenopause that matters. And certainly 71% of ladies who are peri or menopausal with symptoms, so sleep disturbance, brain fog, hot flushes, not sleeping, you know, any myriad of symptoms, 71% of that cohort will describe musculoskeletal pain. And it's rare that it is, you know, one joint. Usually it's multiple joints. So I think in answer to your question, Cecily, no, we can't affect hormones, but what we can do is flag up the potential contribution of hormones, how they make the pain system more sensitive, how they're likely to slow down any response to treatment. And importantly, if ladies are suffering from any of those other symptoms, signposting that speaking to their GP might be a really good idea, because it really can transform their quality of life. Now, the big problem is when you send patients back to GPs, they might do blood tests, and unfortunately, blood tests are notoriously unreliable in the early stages because the hormone levels fluctuate. So there's a brilliant thing called the menopause symptom checklist, and it's more sensitive than blood tests. And basically, your patient you can get it on the internet. There's some fantastic resources. I think there's the Balance website has it on, but essentially, the lady can to tick that, and if she ticks so many, then basically she can take that to the GP, and the GP will now listen. So again, you can be that safe place, that person that's actually listening, that is a really great place to then reflect that back to the patient and actually say, do you think this is something you could do with some help with, or maybe explore some of those associated symptoms? Because it's not, and again, I kind of love what you said, Matt, about, you know, that not trying to be too certain about things, because it's really important. We're not blaming the hormones. We're not saying they're the reason you've got pain. But what we are saying is they could affect your recovery, and they could affect, you know, how sensitive you are to pain, etc. If you've got other symptoms related to it, maybe it's a time to have a chat, because that's just going to make everything easier.
Fantastic. Great answer. And great question, Ceci. Thank you so much for that. Mm. And Cochrane's come back with, wow, can you share the link to this paper? I have a client with this scenario. Yeah, any links which Joe's talked about, I'll make sure they go in the show notes. And yeah, really interesting. Love the idea of the questionnaire, which you can get the patient or client to fill out, and then that'll make the GP actually
listen a bit more, which is a thing of today, isn't it? GPs are pushed. We know how hard work they are. They get limited time. It's very much a case of come back in 4 weeks if the symptoms are still there, regardless of what it is. So if we can help and provide that assistance in pushing things further, then that's great. And this is, again, something we've talked about so much on the show, because soft tissue therapists, when this person comes to see you and they need an hour away from a hectic lifestyle and stress, they know they're going to get it because they feel safe with you. You're going to make them feel great through the touch and the massage. Then this is where you can get this information out of them, build that alliance, and then have them, you know, peel back a few more layers and get them to reveal this information to you about what they're suffering and that. So yeah, amazing answer. Thank you so much. Great. Cecily says as well, yes, that was a great answer. Thank you so much. And Shannon's come back saying thank you. No, great answers, really good. We're so lucky to have you on the show, Joe. We've still got 15 minutes. It's crazy, people.
Well, I can't believe it's gone that quickly. I'm like,
well, it's your fault. It's just everyone just like mouth open, writing notes down. So really cool. You mentioned frozen shoulder a few times.
Mm-hmm.
What is a frozen shoulder? Is it easy to define, or eye roll? For those of you listening to the podcast, that was Joe Gibson.
Doing an eye roll, yeah. The more we know, the more we don't know, really. I think the bottom line is primary frozen shoulder, so an insidious onset frozen shoulder. The evidence is absolutely clear now that 80% of people will have a risk factor that predisposes them. The typical age is in the 50s. If you go to China, they call it the 50-year-old shoulder. The evidence says between 40 and 60, but you look at well-controlled trials, the majority of patients are in their 50s. So there does seem to be some age-related thing too. And then there is potentially a trigger. So there's a great paper by Miller et al., which again, I can send a link to, which basically kind of summarizes where we're up to. And it's basically people are predisposed to get it and then something triggers it. It could be a change in activity. It could be stress. It could be illness, it could be poorly controlled diabetes, whatever. But the risk factors are all the things you'd expect, like diabetes, thyroid, cardiovascular disease, stroke, can be an early sign of Parkinson's, hyperlipidemia, lifestyle type stuff. So basically you have a risk factor and then something tips the balance. So you get this synovial hyperplasia, you get this transition of fibroblast to myofibroblast, and then this thickening of the capsule. But I think where it's challenging, once somebody's stiff and they've got those risk factors, then it becomes arguably less difficult to make the diagnosis. The hard thing is when somebody first comes to see you in that age group with a really acutely painful shoulder that isn't stiff yet, because if you can get those people early, then injection can be a game changer. There is some emerging evidence it can shorten the overall course of recovery, but importantly, it can make a massive difference to people's pain. And it kind of down regulates that whole response that's happening in the capsule. So again, it's if somebody comes to me with a really painful shoulder, particularly if it's very diffuse kind of deltoid region and maybe down to the elbow, that basically abduction and external rotation are horrible, particularly if they do it quickly and they're really struggling to get to sleep, can't find a position of comfort where tendon problems can normally find a position that's comfortable. Frozen shoulder really struggles. And if they do fast movements, their eyes are watering and they can't usually give you any kind of change in load. They can't give you any history of trauma apart from maybe they reach to get something from the back of the car. So again, I'm kind of like a shoulder detective, if you like. I'm stacking up all that evidence. And if I think they have the potential to be a frozen shoulder, as soon as I start to get an inkling of loss of range, then I'm going to send them for injection. Because I think one injection, relative risk is small. And actually what it can achieve for that cohort of patients is, you know, can be a real game changer in terms of their experience of the disease.
That's great. So once again, we've got, if you're a massage therapist, if you're a sports therapist, if you've got that hour to look after somebody and you ask the right questions and recognize the flags or absence of flags, and then you could really change that person's life for the next 5 years by uncovering something which could really help, rather than jumping straight into a whole load of objective orthopedic tests and try to work out something which, by looking at the case history, there's not going to be a solution or an answer or a diagnosis. It's just very interesting.
Yeah, I love, and you know, I was thinking that actually, again, when I was listening to Ian's stuff last week, you know, for me, we get all excited about special tests and everything else, but to me, 80% of your decision making is in that subjective. So by the time I've finished listening to somebody's story, I'm pretty confident what I think the issue is likely to be. And if I'm not, I need to ask some more questions. So my objective kind of proves or negates that hypothesis, I guess.
That's great. Yeah.
And so again, it's just, you know, if somebody's not giving you the answers or you still feel it's a bit muddy and not clear, then maybe a bit more about past medical history, maybe about family history, because that can be very telling, or just a little bit more about the aggravating and easing to get some sort of pattern. And then it just helps you narrow down the likely culprits.
Yeah, I love that. I love that idea. It's so useful, I think, for therapists to realize the subjective is where you build this hypothesis, and then the objective is to test the hypothesis. But unfortunately, on courses, we're still taught, I don't know what physiotherapy is like, but I know that on a lot of sports therapy courses, it's still the case of, yeah, do a bit of objective, just get the name, make them feel good, and then bam, in with the objective, and that's when you work out what's going on. And it's like you've missed so much if you're just going in like that. But it's a shame. That's the problem with education at the moment. But there are some great courses coming out, and hopefully with podcasts like this and guests like yourself, then that's helping with education as well. Amazing. Look at that. Right. 8:50. So frozen shoulder. What else do I try and squeeze into? I love the idea of, I mean, it's my bias, but I love this idea of feeling at ease when you're not sure. And I noticed that on your course, there is kind of like a unit which deals with that, what to do when it doesn't go to plan, how to react. And can you kind of enlighten us on some of the recommendations or things you do when things don't go to plan?
Yeah, of course. So, yeah, because I think the whole purpose of the course is, I just think for clinicians, I know how I felt early in my specialist job. I was meant to be a specialist and I was a bit like, okay, so I've suddenly morphed into this specialist, and actually I just happened to have treated shoulders for a little bit, but not that long. And then I was lucky to go and work with some amazing people, and I did every flipping course that was out there. But then you kind of have to stand back and have your own ideas. And when I looked at it, I thought, you know, really, somebody comes to me and things aren't going as well as they should. And I always love the example, you know, patient comes in, how's it going? Whoa. And it's like, well, have you done your exercises? Which is like, it's your fault.
Yeah, exactly.
Then don't say that. So, and I had a lady in the other week, and she came in and she was, oh, and I said, oh, you know, come on in, have a sit down, tell me about your week. I said nothing about the shoulder. I just said, tell me about your week. And it turned out she'd had this horribly stressful week. Her mum had been admitted to hospital. She'd crashed a car. She'd had to go back to work after a long layoff with sickness and blah, blah, blah. And it was just, you could just, she just stopped and she said, the first time I came to see you, you said that stress and da-da-da-da-da could all make my pain worse. That's why my shoulder's been worse this week, isn't it? And I went, and it was just brilliant, because just letting her talk and say it out loud, it just resonated, because I'd introduced those things right from the outset. So I send them back with a piece of paper, because we know patient recall is rubbish. So when somebody comes in and things aren't going well, the first thing I'd say, don't panic, because there's always a good reason. Maybe I've missed something. So, you know, I'll be completely honest. I had a guy, and I still don't know why I didn't do this, but it was so obvious when you listen to his history that it was his neck, not his shoulder. Mm-hmm. And for some godforsaken reason, I started him on shoulder stuff. And he came back the next time and I looked at my notes and I was just like, geez, I've had a senior moment or something. And he was improving, and it met with his bias, because he was a real lifting weight guy. But guess what? Adding the neck in made a difference. But if you've been very thorough at the beginning, it's unlikely to be that. So when we look at the most like reasons people haven't progressed, they haven't given it enough time. They haven't got a good understanding, so they've not bought into it. The exercises aren't meaningful to them. They've got an expectation of something else and we haven't asked them. So if you don't ask patients what they expect of care, it doesn't matter whether you don't have to do it, but just ask them. We know that's a barrier. So often it's more in that communication domain, or that lack of resonance with the patient about what you've given them to do. And so I quite often, if things aren't going well, just sit down and say, look, things probably aren't progressing how we'd hope. How are you feeling about it? Let's just go back and how are you feeling and what do you understand? And I just check their understanding. And I would say 60% of the time it's in that communication domain. Sometimes it's just they've got a lot of noise from other people, because there's always the experts, aren't there, on everywhere, the treatment shopper that speak to a million other people. Just don't take that personally. That's a psychological characteristic, and you've just got to stick to your game and be true to what you believe and not be swayed by that, because that will give them the faith in you. And then just being confident that if you're doing the right key things and giving it time and progressing it in a sensible way, 80% of your patients are going to progress if they trust you and they believe in the process. So if it's not going well, just sit back, reinvest in 20 minutes of reevaluating where we're up to, and then perhaps reassessing those things. Because I don't know how much time I've got, Matt, but I think very, very briefly, when I have somebody with shoulder pain, I've already decided if it's a shoulder or whether it's the neck, apart from that one guy. And then basically it's like, is it torn and does it matter? So have they had trauma, and is it significant enough that they might have a labral tear or a cuff tear, in which case I might consider some imaging and a referral. But there's all sorts of things around that, around age and activity. Is it stiff? Is it stiff enough? I need to address the stiffness before I can start getting the shoulder moving. And generally you need about 70% of your rotational range in any direction to be able to work through full range with load. And then finally, is it irritable? And that just means my symptom modification probably won't work. So I'm just going to use some other exercises to calm it down so that I can then feed into that. And then the mainstay of my objective is, can I change it using symptom modification? And is it strong enough to do the thing that they want to do? So really simple things. And if I look at problem solving with patients that are sent to me, if it's not the communication domain, then it's one of those things. So the stiffness that's not been addressed adequately, there's something torn that somebody's not picked up, or it's just really irritable and they've got loads of psychosocial stuff going on, which is affecting their pain sensitivity. So I'd love to say I've got this magic box of tricks, but I'm just thorough and just go back to those basic building blocks. And what is it that stopped this helping this patient get back to what they want to do?
That's brilliant. That's a great idea. And I love the idea of just sitting down and encouraging some conversation with the patient. So one, they're going to feel listened to, which most patients would love. And two, you're going to get the answers from them. And the answers will come from them rather than you thinking, oh, what have I missed? What have I done wrong? What am I not getting? Do I need another course? Should I be doing this? You know, so don't doubt yourself, which is lovely. And then let the patient talk some more, and they'll come out with maybe what they haven't done or what they didn't understand. Yeah, very nice answer. Very cool. Which is a great segue to your course now, because it doesn't feel like I'm just trying to like sell you tickets now. It just makes common, it just makes sense now, doesn't it? It's like, because you've got some stuff coming up, and I really appreciate you. Just thanks again for making time to be with us tonight, because I know that I've kind of like been making you jump through hoops and over styles and things to pin you down, but I really appreciate it. So I'll bring this up on the screen. Now, again, remember, people, there's no such thing as CPD for everybody. It all depends. I mean, if you look after runners, then the shoulder success course with Joe Gibson will be fantastically educating, but it might not be the best way for you to invest your money. But hopefully you, thanks to the episode today, you can see whether it's something you'd like to progress with. So Shoulder Steps to Success by Joe Gibson. I will make sure links to all of these go in the notes in case you are interested. But yeah, talk us through what's coming up. I'll put it on the screen so you can see it as well. But yeah, what have you got coming up?
Well, it's a bit. Yeah, absolutely. I've got a few. I've May, June, September, and November in the UK, I think. In fact, there might be one in July as well. I think there's 5 in the UK this year. I do quite a lot of stuff in Europe as well. But those are the. And generally, if you just put Joe Gibson shoulder course, it will take you to Vital Performance, which is certainly running 4 of those. I think a couple of them are fully booked already, but definitely worth a look. And the other thing for people who like online learning, I've got an online course with Clinical Edge. We've got a level 1 and level 2 now, but basically that you can sign up for and just watch at your leisure. But equally, very important to say that I've just done loads of free content, loads of Facebook Lives, loads of podcasts. If you just type in Joe Gibson shoulder and the subject you want to know about, it's likely there'll be a Facebook Live or a podcast about it. So if you don't want to spend money, but you still want to get some free education, there's lots of opportunities without having to sign up for the course. However, I'm very proud of the course, and I'm very proud of the online course, because I think we've got 2 different ways of meeting people with different learning needs. So yeah, it's been great fun putting those things together.
And just to reiterate, I mean, the sort of people who will benefit from your course, do they need a certain level of knowledge already, or?
No, I think if they're just somebody working with patients, trying to get them back to what they want to do, then the course is, I mean, literally I get sports therapists, chiropractors, osteopaths, physiotherapists, we've had Pilates instructors, a whole gambit of people. And I get to know everybody at the beginning. So if there's a bit of physiocentric language, shall we say, then we just make an idiot out of me. And then we just look at how we can explain those things or look at them differently. But the common themes of anatomy and application, it doesn't matter who you are or what your background is.
Fantastic. Sounds great. And look at that. We even got, what better testimony could you have? You've got Andrew himself from ProPress, Sports Medicine, saying class course, communication is a superpower. There we go. Exactly. Get that up on the website now.
Oh, a bit of an Andrew fan. You can never have enough Andrew McCauley in your life.
Oh, he was on fire, wasn't he? At Therapy Expo. Amazing. I've got to get in contact with him to make sure he comes to the STA Theatre again. And this time, Andrew, good to see you. Thanks for joining us live. Yeah, he's got some courses going on about now, hasn't he? Going down in Cornwall, I think. But anyway, this isn't the Andrew Serling show. But yeah, good to see you, Andrew. Thanks. But yeah, great therapist. Really good. Right. Okay. So where are we? It's 9 o'clock on the dot. Thank you so much, Joe. Really appreciate your time. There's so much in there. And it's great as well because it's such a huge topic. We haven't even touched on kind of like what sort of exercises or rehab or how to stimulate tendon or bone or any of those kind of fascinating topics. So I feel the part two may be necessary if we can. I won't hold you to that now. That would be crazy.
Well, as long as it's sooner than 13 years or 11 years or whatever.
Oh, no, I promise. No, I will call you.
You will. I'm just going to remind you. Lots of other people have heard that now, Matt. There's no escape.
It's true. Yeah, no, it won't be. I'm really embarrassed about that. It's terrible. But amazing. Really appreciate your time. Gary Benson has said, thanks, Joe. Sharing your knowledge and experience has been fantastic.
Thank you, Gary.
And also Gary has said here, Gary can't keep my hands out of my pockets, has said, happy to fund an STA member to attend or do the online option for Joe's course. We will work out how we choose someone to attend via our Facebook group. I'll speak to you about it, Matt, when you're free. Was that just to me or was that to everybody? Should I read that out loud? Yeah, that'd be fantastic. Thanks, Gary. That sounds great. Nikki Mansfield has said, tremendous clinical experience. Thank you so much for sharing it with us, Joe. And also Sabrina Monaghan is here saying, thanks very much, Joe.
Glenn Murphy, thank you, everybody, for giving up your precious time.
Like, did I tell you, people? Did I tell you? Was I building it up too much? Not at all. So there you go. No, I really appreciate it. Right. So it just goes for me to say next week, I'm not sure. Next week, normally on the first Tuesday of the month, we do an Ask Us Anything. I haven't actually approached anybody yet. That's where we have a panel of people just looking at questions which have come up across social media. If you are interested in attending an Ask Us Anything next Tuesday, which basically just means you coming and sharing your clinical experience, then contact me, matt@thesto.co.uk. We probably will do one. It's just I've been busy this week. I was in court this week. Very interesting. Ooh. Yeah, I won't go into it, but I've never done it before. Have you done jury service before?
Yes, wouldn't want to do it again.
Yeah, very. Oh, what a roller coaster of emotions. Very strange. Mm. But anyway, so yeah, if you are interested in being on the panel for next Tuesday, I'll probably reach out to a lot of you as well, but drop me an email, make my life easier. Then that's what we'll do. As always, keep an eye at UK_STA for details of what is coming up. And if you listen to the podcast and you do fancy joining us live after listening to this episode, then great. Just come along. 8 o'clock, YouTube or Facebook, Sports Therapy Association, and you can do that. But for now, just once again, thank you so much, Joe Gibson, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Not a problem at all. Thanks, people. Thanks everyone for joining us live as well. And hopefully we will see a few of you listeners next week joining us as well online. Take care. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Sports Therapy Association podcast, putting evidence back into soft tissue therapy.